studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. It's Thursday, September 24th, 2015. Nepal passes a new constitution years after toppling its monarchy. We'll turn to Santosh Giri, a Nepalese constitution lawyer. And nearly 100 years after the death of Jack London, author Cecilia Tichy will paint a portrait of the acclaimed literary giant and his little-known radical political views. Plus, Eric Avila joins us to discuss his book, The Folklore of the Freeway, Race and Revolt in the Modernist City. Today's program, which is coming up after the break, is a taped show as a result of KPFK's staff cuts. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. After nearly a decade of political struggle, the landlocked South Asian nation of Nepal this week passed a constitution. Nepal's monarchy, which ruled the country for more than two centuries, came to a formal end in 2008 and birthed the Federal Democratic Republic of Nepal. The country, still reeling from a devastating earthquake in April that killed nearly 10,000, passed the new constitution with majority support. But riots and violence marred the celebrations, with some groups contending that their rights had been trampled upon. Neighboring India, whose influence over Nepal looms large, is also unhappy, worried that the violence will spill into its north. Nepal has more than 100 ethnic minorities, and the constitution that lawmakers adopted will carve the nation of 28 million into seven provinces. Joining me now to help make sense of it all is Santosh Giri. He practiced constitutional law and human rights in Nepal from 1995 through 2005, and he came to the U.S. to obtain a master's in law from Golden Gate University in San Francisco. He's also the West Coast coordinator for Bibek Shiel, a new political party in Nepal. Welcome to Uprising, Santosh.
Yes.
Thanks for joining us. First, what is the significance of the adoption on Sunday by Nepal of a constitution, a formal adoption of a constitution? How significant is that?
So the constitution of Nepal finally was promulgated in almost 8 years. And the best thing about it is the people of Nepal at least have a constitution right now, whereas there had been a political vacuum. There was a vacuum of law of the land. But with the promulgation of constitution, there has been widespread support towards it, as well as there has been people and factions of the society were dissatisfied about a few things that were not included in the constitution or a few issues that were not addressed. So right now, the best thing that has happened to Nepal in a couple of years, almost a decade, is we have at least the law of the land in its place, and then we have a way forward to it. So the entire section of the society, entire people of Nepal are very, very positive that there will be economic transformation, there will be social transformation, and each and every issue that has been lacking, rights issues and economic issues, will be addressed in the days to come.
And so this was a sort of a new step after the overthrow of a centuries-old monarchy. However, there was a response among Nepalese. There were protests and violence that resulted from the adoption of this constitution. Why?
Yeah, so we have experienced wide range of political ups and downs in almost a decade now, more than a decade, I would say. For the last 25 years, unfortunately, we had 24 governments. So this clearly shows what was the level of political participation, what kind of political environment was in Nepal. So with the overthrow of the monarchy in 2006, the actual democracy that was promised by the political parties to the people, establishment of a republic and federalism in Nepal. These things started coming into picture. So there was a lot of violence when the monarchy was overthrown. But again, at this, right now, when we are promulgating a constitution, meeting those aspirations which are set back in 2006, we still have violence going on. So there are people who have not been addressed. There are rights that have not been addressed in this constitution. Or there has been dissent in the process it has been promulgated. So even as we speak right now, I was reported 3 hours back that there has been some political unrest in the eastern Terai region of Nepal, in Biratnagar area, where there is a clash among police and local people. So these are very critical issues, which I am hoping, as a constitutional expert, as a lawyer from Nepal, that over time, all these rights and issues will be addressed by the law of the land. And it should be, it is pretty much the duty of every Nepali citizen to uphold the constitution, take it positively and move forward. And the constitution at the same time has made provisions that amendments can be made to it, changes can be made to it. So it has definitely given an opportunity for people or the factions of the society or a group who are concerned about not being addressed in the constitution, they can come forward for an amendment of the constitution or any article.
So what you're saying is that there are groups, political groups and ethnic groups in Nepal that feel like they've been left out. Their rights have not been enshrined in the constitution. But because it has taken so long to just get to this moment, that those groups, those interests should attempt to go through the political process and offer amendments to the constitution. Is that the sort of best way forward right now?
Amendments should not be an issue. Whenever there's an amendment, whenever there's a constitution, it can be amendment. Constitution of India has been amendment a couple of times. Constitution of France has been amendment multiple times. We have the best constitution right here in the United States, where it started just with a Bill of Rights, a 2 pages constitution, and we have been having amendments, and all the issues have been addressed. The law of the land should be dynamic, and we cannot just be stuck in one document right now for Nepal, which has been promulgated this week. We cannot just understand it as one document which is going to be there forever and it cannot be amended. So we definitely have a room for amendment there and make changes to it and address the issues and problems to it. But at the same time, the entire international community, the international actors, should also come forward supporting this achievement of people of Nepal, which the Constitution Assembly was not just a dream after overthrowing of the monarchy, but it had actually begun back in 1957, when the people of Nepal were successful in overthrowing the Rana regime, which the people helped the king of Nepal overthrow the Rana prime minister regime and establish the monarchy. And it has been a process laid out by the people for the people. But at the same time, there are sections of our society which have not been properly addressed. I'll give you an example. The core reason for the dissatisfaction on the constitution right now is the Madhes community. It's in the eastern and southern and midsection of Nepal, where we have been hearing a lot of voice for economic rights, social rights, and cultural rights, which definitely these three rights, people have been marginalized. They have not been equally taken into consideration, and all the developments have been pretty much focused on the capital, Kathmandu, and the development have been focused on other ethnicities. So when we are seeing this movement for economic rights, social rights, and cultural rights, at the same time, civil rights and political rights also come into pictures. Now, political parties which are practicing in the Madhes region of Nepal, the Terai region of Nepal, they have been instigating some of them. I'm not blaming all of the political parties, but some political parties and political actors have been instigating violence among these ethnic tribes and ethnic community. So these are the things which could be taken into consideration, and maybe we can move forward making the constitution better day by day. The document could be made dynamic to address the rapidly changing society of Nepal. And at the same time, I'd also like to add that we have India and China, world's fastest moving economy on both sides. Actually, Nepal is situated in a very sweet spot right at this time. And if we do it right, if we make this right, we could equally benefit nationally. We could benefit from our two biggest partners, biggest allies, biggest members.
And I want to get to you. I want to get to what
economic transformation.
I want to get to what India and China's reactions have been. But going back to communities affected, you mentioned the Madhes community. What about India's, Nepal's? What about Nepal's Maoist rebels who had laid down arms some years ago and agreed to join the political process? How did they see the constitution today?
This entire constitution have been driven by the Maoists, I would say, right from the beginning, from 2006.
Right.
But after the first election of the Constitutional Assembly in 2008, it failed to deliver a constitution within a stipulated time of 2 years. Then the Constitutional Assembly had to be re-elected again. The first Constitutional Assembly, Maoists had a majority, but even with a majority, it could not deliver a constitution. The second Constitutional Assembly, people voted against the Maoists, and then the Maoists were a minority. But other traditional political parties like Nepali Congress, Nepal Communist Party, Marxists, Leninists, and other actors came into picture. So Maoists have had a very vital role in this entire process. They have laid down arms. They are in the democratic process. But at the same time, it is very, very unfortunate that Maoist Party itself has been split into three or four different factions, just based on the theory that whatever theory the Maoist Party was established upon to take up arms to capture the entire state has not been accomplished. And now we also have two or three dissent, unsatisfied Maoist factions taking up arms, instigating people in the Terai, and Tharu region, and pushing for the people's uprising in the name of, not being treated equal in this constitution.
Hmm.
So we have both positive aspect of the Maoists, and there's been a negative output as well.
Now, finally, what about India and China? India has certainly had and played a heavy influence over Nepal's politics. How has it responded to this the new constitution being adopted?
Sure. So as soon as the constitution was promulgated, India, China, and America were the countries who first came forward welcoming the constitution. China welcomed the constitution without any conditions. America welcomed the constitution without any conditions. But India, as a very, very important strategic partner, and also we share an open border. So anything that happens in Nepal literally affects India. Anything happens in India literally affects Nepal, especially on the borderline. India actually welcomed the constitution, but conditionally. India pretty much laid out its concern through the special envoy of the Prime Minister, Mr. Narendra Modi. And he delivered his message as a special envoy that if there is political unrest going on in the Terai Madhes region in Nepal, it is directly going to affect the Bihar election that's going to happen in a month. So India is equally concerned about security measures, and India wants to make sure that all the sections of the society, all the people from Nepal, should feel that constitution equally belongs to all of them. Nepal should definitely welcome India's such stance because definitely we have been partners, we have been neighbors for thousands and thousands of years, and we are there to remain. So when Nepal promulgates this constitution, it has to be open enough to hear India out, what concerns India has. And Nepal should be open enough to promise India that these issues, these instabilities will be taken care of. And India should also be asked to help Nepal in fixing these issues, these uprising and unrest.
Right.
But things have been going back and forth diplomatically between India and Nepal for the last 2 to 3 days. And And pretty much, except for these four, two to three elements, India has fully endorsed and supported the Constitution of Nepal.
And the reason that most Americans paid attention to Nepal this year was the horrific earthquake in April that killed nearly 10,000 people. How has that natural disaster and the man-made disaster that followed it because of, you know, poor infrastructure, how has that impacted the political process in Nepal? Is the country still struggling, from the aftermath of that? And did that play into the discussions around and the politics around the Constitution?
Yeah, so unfortunately, we had to go through the earthquake. We had always been talking about the earthquake in Nepal before the earthquake.
But people knew it was going to happen.
When it happened, we saw that the government absolutely lacked level of preparedness. The government did not even have tents or tarps to distribute to its people. The government did not have whatever was required to reach out to the people within 24 hours or 48 hours. That's where Vivek Singh Nepali comes in. Vivek Singh Nepali is a political party. It's a youth-led initiative. And we have been drilling this entire process. We have been practicing the process. And within 20 minutes of the earthquake, Vivek Singh Nepali's volunteers, almost 3,000 of us, we reached out to each and every hospital. We reached out to 18 districts. We delivered the support and supplies, not just physically, but also we have been supporting mentally, we have been supporting psychologically, we have been helping people rehabilitate. The political parties at the same time, after the earthquake, after the earthquake aftermath, what we saw was none of the political parties were actually prepared enough to mobilize its huge amount of members, mobilize its huge amount of financial capability, whereas they could have definitely reached out to the people and gained people trust, which they have lost in the last 25 years. That did not happen. Now, after the earthquake, the entire international community has come forward. Now, international community has committed to $4 billion in reconstruction and resurgence of Nepal. But with the vacuum of the law, with the vacuum of law of land, you know, even that support that is coming from the international community was very, very questionable in terms of accountability and transparency. Now, with the promulgation of the Constitution of Nepal, at least we can ascertain that the people can demand for transparency, the people can demand for accountability, not just the people of Nepal. The entire international community can have a higher level of trust to support Nepal and provide the support they need to come out of this catastrophe.
Well, I want to thank you, Santosh, so much for joining us today and helping shed some light on these issues. Thanks so much.
Thank you. The pleasure is all mine.
I've been speaking with Santosh Giri. He practiced constitutional law and human rights in Nepal from 1995 through 2005. He came to the United States to obtain a master's in law from Golden Gate University in San Francisco, and he's the West Coast coordinator for Bibek Shiel, which is a new political party in Nepal. This is Uprising. We'll be back after this break. This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. The American freeway is both a blessing and a curse. It enables speedy travel across cities and states, but it also divides communities physically and economically. It pollutes and decimates surrounding neighborhoods and provokes major political battles. Often, communities of color have been on the negative end of the impacts of freeway construction. Freeways are associated with urban sprawl and a loss of community. Historic homes are bulldozed or have their values plummet in service to the freeway. But freeways are also unexpected canvases for art and political expression. My guest, Eric Avila, is a professor of history and Chicano studies and urban planning at UCLA. He wrote the book Popular Culture in the Age of White Flight, Fear and Fantasy in Suburban Los Angeles. His latest book is called The Folklore of the Freeway, Race and Revolt in the Modernist City. He now joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising, Eric.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with the origins of America's love affair with the freeway. The Interstate Highway Act of 1956, this launched this great wave of freeway building across the nation. What prompted it? And of course, this was during the time of the Cold War. So the cultural context certainly must have been significant when this act was passed and when the freeways were being built.
Absolutely. The original title of the Interstate Highway Act was the National Interstate Highway and Defense Act, which emphasized the defensive needs of the nation to build a national highway infrastructure that connected cities across the nation. This was the 1950s. Mass suburbanization was taking shape. Americans were enjoying unprecedented levels of prosperity. They were buying automobiles. So the nation needed this infrastructure to connect the nation through this transportation network.
And this played very much into this notion that the automobile would be the sort of center of American existence.
Absolutely. The 1950s marked the heyday of the automobile. It marked the high point of the nation's love affair with the automobile. It was an age of optimism around the automobile and its ability to move people quickly, efficiently, and probably most importantly, privately. Unlike subways and trains, this was a private mode of transportation that represented the kind of summit of the American dream in the 1950s.
And individualism, et cetera. Right?
Absolutely.
Right. You write in your book about the men who were part of the drive to build the freeways, the men who led this vision, of course, all men, all white men. What was the sort of intellectual power and mystique that they wielded and the sense of objective achievement that they were leading?
Well, I think you have to remember that the 1950s was a moment in American culture when experts were revered for their know-how, their technological command. And Americans put a lot of faith in experts, whether they were medical experts or military experts or engineering experts. And the men, predominantly white men, who built the freeways were part of that culture of expertise in the 1950s.
And so they were trusted by most Americans. But then what they found as freeways began to be built around the nation was that not everybody was happy about their community having a gigantic concrete structure tear right through it. Let's talk about San Francisco, where people who lived there revolted at the idea of the Embarcadero Freeway. What were they driven by?
San Francisco is an interesting example because I think it was the first moment when highway engineers discovered that not everybody welcomed their expertise. And in San Francisco, some of the city's most powerful, most affluent communities banded together and said, no, we don't want this freeway coming through our neighborhood. And so they organized a very powerful association of like community alliances to stop official federal plans for highway construction in San Francisco. So as early as 1954, 1955, highway engineers discovered that they could not build seven freeways through the city of San Francisco. And in fact, they only got to build 1.5 freeways because of the powerful influence of community associations in that city.
So this launched a series of what you call freeway revolts around the country, including in Beverly Hills, but also in places like Boston. And what surprised me in your book was your finding that several of these revolts are today interpreted as diverse communities coming together to defeat powerful interests, a sort of racial unity. But in fact, many of the actual struggles against the freeways were led by white elites.
For the most part, yes, that's what I found in my research. these communities fought freeways in cities in the 1960s. And in the 60s, they adopted this discourse of multiracial, interclass unity. And that was becoming a dominant discourse in the 1960s, emphasizing diversity and togetherness. But in the context of actually fighting freeways, whether it was Beverly Hills or Boston, I found that people used the discourse to justify their fight against the freeway. But in fact, the communities that won their fight against the freeway, like mm-hmm. Beverly Hills, like Princeton, like Cambridge, Massachusetts, in reality, were more or less white, affluent, middle class or upper middle class communities that didn't reflect right. the diversity that they embraced. Hmm.
So how did freeway planners use what you call the geography of race in determining where to build freeways? If white communities successfully fought back, then did freeway planners simply opt for poor and communities of color to build these in?
Yeah, for the most part, poor working class communities of color in cities were designated as the paths of least resistance. These were communities that did not have the wherewithal, did not have the resources to stand up and fight against the freeway. There were too many other things to fight at the time.
Right.
But highway engineers in the 1950s and 60s were part of a broader culture that looked upon racial communities as blight and in the way of progress.
And that word blight, you say, sort of became this coded word that actually was used to document how certain communities were seen.
Yes, that's an important part of American urban history going back to the 1920s and 30s when the federal government actively mapped racial communities in order to figure out where to build invasive infrastructural projects like urban planning projects or highway projects. These communities were often targeted, not explicitly targeted, but implicitly targeted right. for their racial character.
Let's talk about gender. So there's race, but then there's also gender. You have a whole chapter in your book about feminism and the freeways, which I had really no idea about. The freeways of the country were being built at around the same time as second wave feminism was coming up. How did feminists respond to the freeway and what did it symbolize to them?
Well, I wouldn't say that feminists actually responded to the freeway per se, but my point in that chapter is to document how women played an important and visible role in fighting freeways in many cities, as mothers, as community organizers, or just simply as, you know, tough organizers. And the visibility of women in the fight against the freeway coincided with second wave feminism in the United States. And for many women, and this is what I argue in the chapter, highway construction symbolized a threat to families, schools, parks, and other institutions of community stability.
Right, because when freeways were built, of course, one thing that happened is the communities just got spread apart more. And you point out in your book that it represented a subsequent suburbanization that further relegated women to be sort of confined in their home to the drudgery of household work.
Yeah, well, that's certainly one aspect of the history of suburbanization is that it had negative consequences for women. I mean, in the early 60s, Betty Friedan wrote The Feminine Mystique, which was largely an indictment of suburbanization for the way that it consigned women to the private sphere, to the, as you say, the drudgery of housework and the privacy, the isolation of the suburban home.
So the other aspect of freeways, which is also surprising to me, is art. Art about the freeways and art on the freeways. Mm-hmm. So you have a section in your book with color plates of all the art that's been inspired by freeways. First, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, one of my main arguments in the book is that urban communities of color, because they had very limited resources to take on freeway builders, they had to find alternative means to express their protest or their grievances against highway construction. And for many working class urban communities of color, art and other forms of cultural expression become vital and necessary forms of political expression. Scholars often tend to divide the political from the cultural, But in the history of building freeways in cities, art became a necessary political response to the destruction that, that highways inflicted upon urban communities of color. So a lot of the art in the book, I argue, reflects a racial critique of what freeways did to cities during the 1950s and 60s.
Mm. And then there's art on the freeways, one of the best examples of which, you also have photos of this in your book, is Chicano Park in San Diego. But we also have Judy Baca's work in Los Angeles on the freeways.
Right, yeah. Baca is an important example of how people from these communities strive to transform the freeway and its presence in their neighborhoods into a community asset by using it as a canvas upon which to express their own particular sense of identity, community, and history. So Chicano Park is another example where these amazing murals are painted on the columns and surfaces of a highway interchange in the heart of San Diego's Mexican-American barrio, which in that sense, they are able to transform the meaning of the freeway to make it relevant to their sense of community, history, and identity.
One of the stories that you tell throughout your book that I think is perhaps one of the most extreme examples of freeway fights is Hawaii's H3 freeway, which became, I believe, one of the most, if not the most expensive freeway construction project in U.S. history, and it caused major political turmoil on the ground. Tell us that story and why it's important.
It's a very interesting story. H3 was a highway designed in the early 1960s, designed to connect Honolulu with a military base on the other side of the island. And initially, people in Hawaii protested the freeway on environmentalist grounds. But as the fight continued, the tone of the debate shifted later in the 1970s and 1980s, and indigenous groups in Hawaii with a strong sense of connection to Hawaii's indigenous past began to organize in protest against the freeway because of its destruction of sacred indigenous grounds. And what I find interesting about the story of H3 is the kind of unexpected consequences of building a freeway and how it spurred or provoked this kind of racial response among people who had a connection to Hawaii's indigenous past. Mm.
And so sort of ultimately, when you've had this history throughout the United States of the freeway causing turmoil, many freeways being disrupted, several freeways ending in unexpected dead ends, but whole neighborhoods, especially black neighborhoods, wiped out, as you point out, in cities like Detroit and New Orleans. Ultimately, what sort of outcome or pattern of outcomes have you seen by communities of color, you know, in addition to treating them as canvases, where they've come to figure out ways to live with the freeway?
Well, I think that's been an ongoing struggle. I don't think there's one clear answer as how to live with a freeway. But in my book, I try to document the many, many attempts to reconcile the presence, the unwanted presence of a freeway in urban communities of color through art, through historic commemoration, and many, many other forms that I call the folklore of the freeway. And I think it's important that we recognize these efforts because they're kind of invisible to us.
Right. And finally, how has the attitude of engineers, today's freeway men, changed, having seen this history unfold and these struggles continually erupt? Have they changed and understood that this objective approach to building freeways as simply efficient ways to get from one place to the other really needs to have a cultural context?
Yeah, we don't live in the 1950s anymore. We don't celebrate the automobile and the freeway like we used to in the 1950s. And today, the official culture of planning has changed in significant ways to emphasize the community context in which freeways are built. But one of the big arguments of my book is that that lesson comes from urban communities of color that insisted upon cultural context, community context, going all the way back to the 1960s. So, you know, long before planners discovered context, activists in Black communities and Chicano communities were insisting upon cultural context and inventing their own creative ways to assert that context. And today, you can't build a freeway without going through layers upon layers of bureaucracy, and that bureaucracy is there to make sure that the mistakes of the past have not been repeated.
Eric Avila, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
My guest, Eric Avila, is an associate professor of history and Chicano studies and urban planning at the University of California in Los Angeles. His book is called The Folklore of the Freeway, Race and Revolt in the Modernist City. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. When I was a child, one of my very few exposures to American literature was White Fang, the acclaimed novel by Jack London set in the ice and snow of the Yukon Territory of Canada. Indeed, most U.S.-born Americans know of Jack London through his literary works, but few know that London was also an avowed socialist, a fierce orator, and considered himself a revolutionary. In 1914, London told a Los Angeles Times reporter, "If just by wishing I could change America and Americans in one way, I would change the economic organization of America so that true opportunity would obtain and service instead of profits would be the idea, the ideal, and the ambition animating every citizen." Joining me now on the phone is Cecilia Tishy. She is the author of Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America, and the William R. Cannon Jr. Professor of English and Professor of American Studies at Vanderbilt University. Her earlier books are Civic Passions, Exposés in Excess, and Embodiment of a Nation. Welcome to Uprising, Cecilia.
Good to be with you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, I confess I was very surprised to hear about this and read about this aspect of Jack London. Certainly, writers and fiction writers in the past in the United States have had political views that might be considered radical. But Jack London, I think, was beyond that. How would you characterize, to somebody who only know his fiction books, how political of a person he was?
Well, I would say that he earned his politics by working at many manual labor jobs under terrible conditions of that time. It was the first Gilded Age after the Civil War, the later 19th century, all those decades. And he had just these toilsome jobs in a cannery where he saw co-workers' fingers just sliced because of the lethal machinery that had no safety equipment. He worked in a jute mill for 10 cents an hour, not for fun, because he was trying to help his family. And the shifts went on until the boss said you could go home. And two more of these jobs. He shoveled coal into a boiler, a fiery furnace to heat a boiler for steam for an electric company. And he was seduced into thinking by the employer that perhaps he could start at the bottom and rise the way Horatio Alger's heroes did. And London learned he was only being exploited and he would never rise. And the job damaged his wrists. They swelled. They were sprained. He wrapped leather around his wrists, and if he had not quit, I think he would have perhaps been permanently disabled. One more job. He worked in a steam laundry, highly mechanized, scalding vats of starch, heavy irons, and one of his friends stopped by to see him and said, "Jack, they've turned you into a robot. You've hired out as a slave." So through his youth and late teens, he had these excruciating work experiences, so that, again, he earned the right to think more Americans deserve a better shot. Work conditions should be better than this. Wages should be better than this. And he became, as he realized, a socialist. But Sonali, when he was asked, well, what does that mean, socialism? He had two basic answers. One, Americans and all people are social animals. We want to live in society together. That's what we are. That's who we are. And second, don't we deserve a better organization politically, economically, than the one we're now in? You read that quote to the 1914 newspaper reporter, and that really sums it up. For him, there was not some fierce doctrinaire wish to abolish the industrial age. He thought that was a wonderful advancement. Consumer products, presumably for everyone, but too few were enjoying the good things that were being produced. And that led all that, his work and seeing the inequality and the maladjustment of society. So he became, I think, a reformer in his fiction.
So his own class background then informed his political positions. But as a fiction writer, and of course, during his time, his heyday, fiction writers were really seen as in the intellectuals, particularly those writers who were considered literary giants, were seen as a very important part of the intellectual fabric of the United States. So that enabled him to have a megaphone, if you will, well before we had the internet or other means of mass communication that we take for granted today. How did he then sort of live his life as this acclaimed person? Did he infuse his literary works with his politics? Did he keep them pretty separate?
Well, he infused, but he did so subtly. I mean, if we remember, He had the great advantage of a mother who taught him to read at age four. He was four.
Wow.
He loved reading, and he always had librarians at the Oakland Public Library, Oakland, California, where he lived. And the librarian saw this sort of scruffy, bright-eyed boy, and they helped him select books. So this was very important. Then when he felt it was literally a do-or-die moment, if he kept on with these manual labor jobs, he felt he would be dead before middle age. He saw others around him wearing themselves out and thought, they're like old horses getting ready for the glue factory. So he gave himself this chance to make it as a writer. Now, of course, he had been to the Yukon Klondike, and you introduced this issue yourself. He found very little gold, but he all of his supporters say, you really mine the gold of the stories that you were able to produce. But he was back from the Klondike. It's late 19th century. He decides to become a writer, if possible. He's working 16, 19 hours a day, hammering out on this very primitive typewriter, one of them that printed only capitals, and he's sending out manuscripts, and they're coming back like boomerangs. Then he hit it, two stories, one in the Atlantic Monthly on the East Coast, one on the Outlook magazine on the West Coast, and he was on his way. As of the publication of The Call of the Wild, and that is 1903, he became famous and a celebrity author. Now, as he went forward, by then editors were clamoring for his work, his stories for magazines, and sometimes serialized in newspapers like Sunday supplements, and of course the books, the fictional books that just tumbled out one after another. So he was making a good deal of money. In fact, he was the first American author to to earn from his writings $1 million.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's when the five-cent nickel was the coin of the realm, so to speak. But as he, in a sense, became a wealthy man himself, he never abandoned his principles, but he also knew that his livelihood depended upon his popularity with his stories, with his novels, and he always had his readers in mind. He said to his editor, "I delivered to the market marketable products," and he took pride in that. But we find in so many of his books and his short stories reform messages. They're not blatant. He's not a preacher, but in many, many of his books, we find scenes that try to stir the reader's conscience and stir the reader's mind. He called this feeling a noble discontent. In other words, the reader, for high purposes, moral purposes, ethical purposes, the noblest part of the reader's mind would become discontented at the status quo as London presented it in the depths of a story or a novel. Your conscience would be troubled, your mind would stir, you'd start to think, is this the way we should be? For instance, so much child labor at the time, as London himself had been a child laborer, a boy laborer, the people who were fortunate enough to afford his books and have the free time to read them would never have thought of sending their children into the mills and the mines and the factories. Their children went to school. But they thought that the children of immigrants or the poor perfectly well should be at work. They would help their families. They would develop their characters and a sense of discipline. This was the kind of delusion. And London's stories, one of them about a child laborer based on his own work, it's called The Apostate. It's about a boy mill worker. And that's the sort of fiction that he hoped would have a reformist drive to it, get people thinking along different lines, get laws passed, regulations passed for a better society. That's what he was about.
So the story of how he sort of how he became a rich man and expressed his political views is fascinating, and I'm wondering if how he compared to his contemporaries of the time. Upton Sinclair is another person that, you know, most people who know anything of his work know that he was very much a political person, and much has been written about Upton Sinclair, and he wrote both political and non-political books, or at least books that were fiction, I should say, and non-fiction that were political. How did Jack London fit within compared to his contemporaries?
Well, that's really a really good question. You know, if we look at the span of his contemporaries, here are the investigative reporters whose popularity came as the nickname was muckrakers. Ida Tarbell revealing that the Standard Oil Company, Rockefeller's oil company, had conducted its business illegally, Ray Stannard Baker looking at strikers in Chicago during the Pullman strike and exposing the hardship of the workers who were on strike, who had been, in a sense, put out of their jobs. So in one sense, we have the muckrakers. And then there are popular novelists like, there's one, we probably don't remember his name, Robert Chambers. For a brief time, he was as popular as Jack London, wrote adventure stories. And then mystery stories. Mary Roberts Rinehart was getting her start with popular fiction, and so was Edna Ferber on the women's side. So a great kind of spectrum of writers. Now, you've asked specifically, what about someone like Upton Sinclair?
Right.
And, of course, The Jungle is a classic and has remained so. And in fact, I included it in a class just a few weeks ago right here. But London differed from Upton Sinclair in one, I think, crucial way. Sinclair, I would even say, sort of barraged his reader with social injustice on almost every page. Some of Sinclair's work was highly popular, like The Jungle. London listened, I think, to what Stephen Crane, who died young, author of The Red Badge of Courage, but Stephen Crane said, "Preaching is fatal to art in literature." Fatal. What he obviously meant is that if you're seeking spiritual guidance, go to a house of worship.
Right.
If you're writing fiction, you're in a different game. And London, I think, was very concerned about what his reader would think and feel along the course of a story or a long novel. He was not willing to besiege his writer, I'll say besiege, with political messages. You know, he learned something from his lectures. On the stage of a lecture, he would say, "There are 1 million people in the United States who are not properly fed or housed. How can this be in this rich country?"
Hmm.
And then he would say, "There are 80,000 children working out their lives in textile mills. How can this be? What does the great capitalist say about this? Nothing." Well, when he put these kinds of questions in essays, the essays were not always welcome. And Jack London would sometimes be called an anarchist, a communist, a socialist, as if all those isms were all just one thing. And London learned that in fiction, he could reach an appreciative, receptive audience in ways that he could not in his essays. And there are collections of his essays, and some of them are quite hard-hitting.
Hmm.
His wife said, "Every time Jack gets called a socialist, his book sales slump." And so it was important to him to kind of keep taking the measure of his audience and he in relation to that audience. So he and Upton Sinclair were allies in the socialist cause. And when Upton Sinclair edited a compilation of literature from centuries ago on social injustice, he asked Jack, "Would you write the introduction?" And London did. And then, of course, anything that London was attached to was promised a better sale than it would otherwise have. So the two men were allies and good acquaintances, but they differed in how they approached the public.
Finally, Cecilia, we talked about his approaches to his political, Jack London's political views on how he would like to see the economy reconfigured, so much of which is, of course, very relevant today. But he also had views on foreign policy, which, of course, at the time was the early days of the U.S. empire. How would you characterize his views on U.S. foreign policy?
Oh, Sonali, that's such an important question. Because, of course, London was an internationalist as well as an American. Initially, when the Spanish-American War took place and Admiral Dewey sailed into the Manila Harbor in 1898 and the Spanish fleet practically collapsed and America seemed triumphant, and Jack London was exultant about this. This was great. But when he, on his own sailboat that he ordered with his wife and a small crew, sailed into the South Seas and also to Hawaii, he saw imperialism at work. And he saw that what happens when the great powers, Western Europe, France, Germany, England, and now the United States, and their battleships and their merchants began to occupy islands and virtually, I'm going to say virtually enslave workers. They were contract workers on some of these islands, preparing coconut, dried coconut that would serve as a foaming agent on soap. So what London saw is the oppression of the native peoples, saw that their ways of life were radically disruptive, that their own prosperity diminished. He saw imperialism as a takeover by the powerful to the loss of life and quality of life to the native peoples on the islands, one after another in the South Pacific, and then also in Hawaii, where the native Hawaiians had somehow been displaced, and the whites had taken over for the sugarcane plantations, for the pineapple plantations. Queen Liliuokalani, who was, in a sense, herself removed by the elites of the pineapple and sugar industry, and sent to prison in the former palace. Hawaii was, of course, its own autonomous kingdom. And Jack London was very dismayed and angry. And in some of his stories of Hawaii and of the South Pacific, if you read them carefully, you can see exactly his critique of the practices of the imperial powers.
Well, Cecilia, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. So much more to discuss, but of course our listeners and viewers can find out more of the fullness of Jack London's political life in your book, Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America.
If you order the e-book, what you get, in addition to the print and all the pictures that are in the print book, you get 8 motion picture old-time movies, because I was able to get a series of archival motion pictures of Jack London's own life and times, and I think they add a wonderful dimension to the print book.
Wonderful. So that's the e-book version of your book that we've been discussing, Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America. Thank you so much, Cecilia, and best of luck to you with the book.
Thanks so much, Sonali.
Cecilia Tichy is the William R. Kennan Jr. Professor of English and Professor of American Studies at Vanderbilt University. Her earlier books are Civic Passions, Exposés in Excess, and Embodiment of a Nation. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and technical director. Teddy Robinson is our audio engineer. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. Find us at facebook.com/uprisingradio and follow us at twitter.com/uprisingradio. I'm Sonali Kulhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you next time.